Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Feeling Lighter podcast by WeShape, where we are shedding old beliefs one episode at a time, because we all know the bottom line is how you feel about yourself is what actually changes everything in your life. So I'm Katie. I'm here with our co-host, Dr. Lisa Folden, and our special co-host today, co-founder of WeShape, Tyler. Welcome, you both, you all.
Thank you.
Thanks for the welcome.
We're going to dive in today. We have a great guest today, the millennial therapist. Many of you may follow her on social. I know I do. Mm-hmm. And so I was so excited when I found out we got to book her. And I think I have a whole page of questions. So we're going to dive right in. So Lisa, why don't you read her bio and we'll make an introduction.
Absolutely. Dr. Sarah Kubrick is an existential psychotherapist, consultant, writer, and author of It's On Me. She was born in Yugoslavia and raised in Canada. She is passionate about helping people seek change and live authentic, free, and meaningful lives. Her interest in psychology stems from her personal experience living through wars, navigating complex relationships, and continually learning what it means to be human. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
I think our listeners and myself want to see if we can start off with a basic question, which is, can you please give us the definition of an existential psychotherapist?
That would be helpful.
That would be great.
You know what? This is probably the most asked question. And
okay.
You know what? It's a great question. Mm-hmm. I think usually the question is framed, what is existential therapy versus normal therapy, which makes me chuckle.
Normal.
As if there is, normal, as if there's like a really standardized way of practicing. So to explain existential therapy, the best way is to say that every therapist operates from a modality, from a theory. So this theory helps them understand the client, helps them understand how to get the client from point A to point B. So let's say that you were an attachment therapist. If a client sat across from you, as they're telling you their story, their narrative, their experiences, you'd be looking for their attachment style. Mm. As an existentialist, when I'm sitting there and people are telling me their stories, I'm looking for responsibility. I'm looking for freedom. I'm looking for themes of meaning and death and anxiety. And so existential therapy comes from existentialism, which is a philosophy, and we work with universal concepts that we think are applicable for everyone, and that's what helps me conceptualize what my client is going through and then helping guide them.
Wow.
I love it. Wonderful answer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You had you've practiced that answer before. well, one of the things, I mean, you're called the millennial therapist, and I think all three of us fit into that category as millennials. So, you know, I want to start by this idea. You talk about self-loss, and I can only speak from my own personal experience, but I have gone through my own journey of these were your goals that were set up for you. It's weird because it wasn't explicitly like my parents didn't tell me you have to do this, you have to do this, you have to do this. But society, culture, you know, my beliefs told me that I had to do certain things, like, you know, get married, get a degree, all of these paths. And I'm not saying I have any regrets about that. But I am saying that I can feel self-loss along that journey. And in more recent times, I have been unraveling that self-loss and what decisions were made out of consciousness, what decisions were made out of true authentic self. So I don't know if you can speak to this concept of self-loss and like what does it look like for many of us? I don't know if my experience resonates with others, if you hear that all the time, but maybe you can go more into that.
Absolutely. No, thank you for sharing. I think it's incredibly common, yet it's equally painful and not talked about. And this is why I wanted to write the book, because how many individuals haven't grappled with the question of who am I or been feeling so consumed by life that they felt like they were drowning or that they genuinely were so disoriented that they didn't know what they wanted or prefer or even liked in life. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of people have these experiences where they will either follow society and what is right, quote unquote, for them. That was my experience in a sense where if you looked at my life from the outside, I was like the overachieving 20-year-old who like managed to find her perfect guy and got married because she was so in love, and she was in grad school and she was helping her community, and like people come up to my parents and be like, you must be so proud. And that is the point where that is the most I've ever hated myself, was being this version of me. And that was so incredibly painful and confusing because I was doing what was right. Where was my reward? No one else would, you know what I mean? And no one else would resonate. They would, when I would share my dissatisfaction with my life, I felt ungrateful.
Yeah.
And people would view guilty. Me as ungrateful, is super guilty. Especially with my background of living through wars as a child, that version of my 20s was something I couldn't have even comprehended or hoped for. So that little girl in me was also like, how dare you not be happy with where you are? You could have died. You could have a very different life than you do right now. And so a lot of people are caught in this system with that doesn't really support authenticity, that doesn't really support this development of self. And then there's others, and I kind of straddle both, which you've had something traumatic happen to you. That made a shift from self-exploration or expression to self-preservation. So I entered self-preservation at such a young age. I wasn't exploring what kind of things I liked. From age 9 till 24, I was just trying to survive. Even when the threat was gone, I didn't compute that. And that's what trauma does. And so a lot of people are on survival mode and therefore don't have the capacity or the skill or the safety necessary to actually develop their sense of self and understand who they are.
That's so big. I'm also looking at your book right here. I feel like this is a good transition. I really like the subline, the accept hard truths, discover yourself. And it's been my experience that the more you lean into those difficult moments, those challenging moments, those fears, those insecurities, and the more you accept those hard truths, the more you have the capacity to find yourself. And generally, it feels like the more suffering you allow, the more joy you also allow in. And I'm just curious if you can speak to the process of going from self-loss to finding yourself.
Yeah, it was not quick and it was not pleasant. I think people like to talk about healing as this like really wonderful experience.
Right.
I'm just going to pause awkwardly. Yes and no. There are wonderful things when you start to heal those wounds and when you taste that authenticity. But my God, is it hard. And it's so painful. And I almost felt like I had to unravel further before I could become. And that process of unraveling was so difficult, and it entailed facing a lot of truths that I avoided my entire life. It gets so almost absurd that I will give you an example. I was sitting across my therapist. I was in therapy at the time, at the height of my self-loss because I developed panic disorder. And I was sitting across from her and we're talking, and we're like 10 sessions in. I'm like, oh yeah. So when I lived through wars, and I say it really casually, and I was like, and when I was in the bomb shelters, and I say it so casually, and she's like, you know, these are not normal human experiences. Like, there are consequences to the fact you've experienced this. I have normalized my trauma to such an extent that I didn't even acknowledge the fact that it impacted me, acknowledge the fact that it hurt me. I went on with such deep denial. And also, I think what didn't help is that everyone around me experienced similar things. So we completely normalized something that was unhealthy and damaging and painful. And so for me, the truth of being like, oh no, I do have trauma, I had to face that. And that sounds almost silly because it's so obvious, like it's an obvious trauma. But it wasn't for me. And there's so many reasons why I wanted to resist that particular trauma. And so I had to look at my marriage and go, you know what? I probably shouldn't have gotten married so young. I have no idea. I have no idea who I am. And I do not identify as being a wife right now. And I find that that relationship made it very difficult for me to kind of figure out who I was. And there were so many hard truths of like, the hardest being that I was the perpetrator of my own self-loss. Yes, what happened to me as a child was terrible, and that probably offset this self-loss path. But the reality is that my daily decisions were what actually led me to the ultimate state of self-loss. And that truth was the hardest to swallow.
Oh man, it was ultimately, it was on you,
huh? Right. It was ultimately on you. On me. Exactly.
And all of us. Yeah. Wow. Thanks for sharing.
Do you, everything that you said, like I didn't live through wars. I grew up in a chaotic home, very tumultuous childhood. And I too have normalized it. Like I laugh and talk about it. I do talk to my therapist about it somewhat more seriously sometimes. But I do feel like it was, I don't know if I want to say this, like par for the course. You know what I mean? Like I feel like, I think I was taught to sort of wear it as like, oh, well, it made you who you are. So it's important. Be appreciative because like you said, it could have been worse. Yeah. You could have died. Mm. My aunt, I don't even know if I want to share this story. I'm trying to think. Okay, so my mom was a very young mother. She had me at 15 and she had a drug problem. And so my aunt and my grandmother took a big part in raising me. And sometimes they would let my mom sort of try to take the reins and be a parent, but she would make some pretty bad decisions. And one of those decisions was resulted in me being left with a person that no one knew. And fortunately, this person was kind enough to bring me home. And I was like two, I think. And my aunt was like freaked out, like there's this man at the door with my niece and I don't know him and he's had me for several days. And so I think, exactly. So I think about like, what could have happened to me, right? How I could have never made it back home. And so there's a part of me that like in my life now, like, oh, I'm an adult and I have a good career and I'm married and have kids. And so, yes, I should be so grateful and thankful. But also there is this like thing within you that I feel like I'm going through sort of what you're talking about in this process. And so I wonder if it has a little bit to do with our generation, like this whole millennial thing, like we were just kind of told to push through all this hard stuff. Things could have been worse. It used to be worse before, you know, live your life and do the things you're supposed to do. And then you'll be happy and everything will be fine. And then like, it's not, it's not just fine. And I'm like 42 now. And I'm like, it's not just fine. So I don't know. I don't know if you're seeing this with, and again, you're the millennial therapist, but do you feel like this is a big thing with our generation of, you know, young adults, you know, at this point?
For sure. I like how I'm like, I will speak on behalf of all the millennials.
All the millennials. I am the one.
I am the queen of millennials. So thank you so much for sharing your story because it's so powerful and vulnerable. And I think so many of us have these stories and just don't share them. And the narratives around millennials is so harmful. And it's been so harmful for so long. Like, first, the behaviors that were modeled to us were very disengaged in terms of do not feel your emotions, do not express your emotions, do the hard thing, be grateful. And that's something that we've adopted. And the biggest difficulty, I think, for millennials was when our reputation started to suffer. I don't know if you guys remember this, but millennials were the flaky, live in your parents' basement, uninspired, too privileged, too sensitive, to everything generation. Right. Mm-hmm. And then I think we wanted to prove everyone wrong. And
that's a good point.
That was, you know, we wanted to prove people wrong. And it's unfortunate because I think our generation started to explore mental health. It was the first generation that really stepped into mental health. Mm-hmm. But then because of all the outside pressure, we just kind of closed in and it became about, well, I'm going to prove you wrong. I'm going to be successful. I'm going to not have that traditional job. I am going to have the life I've always wanted. And you said that I couldn't. And part of that rebellion, I think, was great. But what it did is it made us a little ashamed of who we were in terms of our emotionality, our past. We were very forward focused. So that's what I often see with millennials is this drive, this insane work ethic and drive, which is so beautiful and something that we couldn't have. Like now when we talk to our parents' generation, they're like, we never said you guys were lazy. It's like, no, you did.
Yeah, you 100%
did. You did. I remember. I have receipts. No. But I just feel like we fought so hard on one front and then during it, we kind of sacrifice ourselves along the way. And I think a lot of millennials sacrifice themselves into their true selves to accomplish either a goal, to prove someone wrong, to not repeat what their parents did. And none of them are bad goals to have. They're just not worthy goals of what you've sacrificed.
I mean, this idea of self-loss is so important. And I think a lot of people in the We Shape community feel this. It's like, we did everything you said we should do. We followed the diet. We followed the exercise plan. We got the degree. We got the partner. We got the kids. And like, we're not that happy.
Why do I still feel empty?
And I also, maybe at some point we can dissect the word happy, because sometimes I get triggered by that word, because I'm like, maybe like there's more than one emotion in the human experience that we're all should be achieving. I have really, in true transparency, have been on a path of discovering self-loss for the last 2 years. And you were very right when you say it's slow. And I do see all of the things that we're all talking about in terms of the minimizing of the experiences, the buckle up. I know I'll just quickly share one. I actually just had this discovery last week with my therapist when she does EMDR work with me, and she wants to start with like your least traumatic event. So she's like, something that's like under a 5. And I was like, like my dad, he would like get drunk and forget to come pick me up. And I would like put my backpack on and be on the couch and look out the window and he'd never come. And that would happen all the time. And she was like, that's your lowest one. And I was like, it's like no big deal. Like, I actually had this most incredible stepdad, and I would never actually want him to be the one who raised me. Like, I had completely bend and shifted and molded the experience so that I could be grateful for the stepfather that I had, but I completely never mourned the loss. And she took me through, she kept going back. She was like, we're not moving on until I see that you experience what this should have felt like for your, as you as a child.
Wow.
And it took, I think, in my fourth session of the EMDR, then I was like, oh no, this is like a 9 for me, but I see how I made it a 4.
Right.
Because I just thought, if I make it a 9, then it doesn't show the reverence and gratitude that I have for the life that I have today as a result of him not being there. So it's just this mind fuck, right, of just like me constantly trying to bend and shift to minimize. But I say all of this because when I'm going back to that idea of self-loss, I have my best friend, she always says this to me. She goes, Katie, what do you want? Like, can you practice fantasizing what you want? And I'm like, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. It's like to discover that you have lived for everybody else your whole life. There's guilt associated with that. There's almost shame associated with that. And like, my question to you, this is a very long way of getting to a question. But
I love it. Thank you for sharing.
How do you even discover what you want? Mm-hmm. Like, I can't ever answer her when she says that. I'm like, I like hiking. She's like, it's like, I don't know. You know, it's like, I don't even know how to answer that question.
Okay, I'm going to keep this as short as possible. I'm going to give 3 pointers.
Okay.
One is, we need to, I think, deconstruct the concept that we find ourselves.
Oh.
I think that we create ourselves.
Okay.
How can there be a sense of self that you didn't create? Where does it come from? So that is something that's super mainstream psychology. And it really depends. Are you an essentialist, an existentialist, what your worldview is, what your religion is? It really, there's so much that can feed into this narrative of you find who you were meant to be. As an existentialist, I have an unsexy way of seeing that, which is you first exist, then you create your essence.
Okay.
By the choices you make, by who you become. So when you look at it that way, that process of finding things becomes a process of creating or trying things. It becomes a little more proactive.
It's less of a deficit.
So how do you know? It's less of a deficit. It's like, how do you know? You try.
Yeah.
You literally try. And the other example is you observe, or not example, but it's like you need to observe yourself. When you go on a first date, think about how hyper-focused you are. Oh my God. They cross their legs and their toes pointing at me. Oh my God, they brush my shoulder. Was that on purpose? The way he talks about his mom. Do you know what I mean? Like
reading into all the things.
Totally. Their voice, the way they describe themselves, like everything matters so much. So just do the same thing for yourself. We give ourselves cues all day long. We just don't pick up on them. Mm-hmm. So I think observation, not being scared of trying and molding your existence, playing with your existence, creating your existence. I think it's really liberating. You can also and will also change your mind with what you like and prefer. You should. You should be a very different person in 10 years. So this ultimate, like, who am I? What do I like? Container that we're trying to shove our existence into and then label it and put it on a shelf is such, I think, a wrong way of living life, because it's really restrictive. It's really limiting. And I don't think that that's what life is about. I don't know what your question was. I don't know what my third point was. But I really
I appreciate this. And like, in all transparency, Tyler and I'm always curious about if you see, you know, for people who identify as female, if you see sort of like loss of self even more, because he and I have this dynamic of, you know, like, Katie, I know exactly what I want. How do you not know what you want out of life? And I'm like, I don't know. One ever asked me. I just take care of the needs in front of me. And that's how I live my life, you know. And so do you see a difference like in terms of people who identify as female? I will say I appreciate that differentiation and that perspective shift. If there's nothing to find, you're good as you are. What do you want to create? How do you want to unfold that creation? And it's okay to like test and try. And it's not about I'm in search of and I have to, but here you are today. And what is the next step of your evolution? More of a creative part of who you are. So I appreciate that. But do you notice a difference with like, do you feel like millennial females are have a harder time with this?
Yeah. And also with the creation comes the responsibility. I snuck it in there. It's like you're very much responsible for what you do. Yeah. Yes, I do see a difference. But I find that individuals who identify as female, generally their loss unfolds in relationships so often. And I think part of that is the messaging we receive. For many of us, still the hide is to get married. That is like, oh my God, you did it. I can tell someone that I just got like a really cool deal and that I'm working on something. And then I can tell someone that I got engaged or got married. The responses, the volume of those responses will be so different.
Yeah, you're right.
The text, the phone calls, the excitement. And that is absurd to me because it's like, this wasn't a task. Like this was like, you know what I mean? It's like did I trick someone into loving me? Like, am I supposed to feel honored? Like, am I supposed to feel honored that someone wants to be with me? Like, it really, it's so shocking how we treat women. And then we go, well, why do women struggle with their sense of self? Why do they struggle to explore? And it's like, because that's not the society we live in.
I do want to just say I've always thought it was this is going to maybe be an unpopular opinion, but I'm going to just admit it. I've always thought it's very bizarre that we congratulate people on marriage.
Really?
I'm like, I just think it's kind of bizarre. I'm like,
it's
so
weird.
Do I get a congratulations if I just decide to be by myself? Like what? Why? I didn't do anything.
No, you get publicly shamed. Yeah, that
is. You do get publicly shamed.
Right.
Yeah, it's like you know, being single as, I mean, there's just so much here. Another podcast. It's a tangent. But yes, to answer your question, yes, I do. We're focused on needs. We're focused on being utilized. We're focused on, you know, taking responsibility for everyone else, but no one's really telling us to take responsibility for ourselves. So there's a lot of beliefs and structures that need to kind of be deconstructed, I think, before we will have an equal or fair chance of figuring out who we are.
That's so true. Yeah. Can I go back to something? I really appreciate you both sharing your stories and having a hard time connecting with the feelings of how you might have felt in that moment because maybe life's great now.
Right.
So we don't have to feel those feelings. And I'm just curious from your perspective, how essential is it for someone to connect with those feelings of maybe loss and fear and sadness and whatever else may come up in order for them to find themselves?
Well, remember, we're not finding ourselves.
Create themselves.
We're creating ourselves.
Yeah, come on, guys.
You're not listening.
You're not listening. Triggered. No, I'm just kidding.
Typical man. Not paying attention.
I'm like rolling my eyes. No, I'm just kidding. Totally.
Man, I said that with such intensity, too. You guys blew it for me.
Sorry.
All right.
It's still a great question.
How essential is suffering?
How is it's you know, ask any existentialist. It's the foundation of change. No, I don't think you can actually evolve without facing what is. You don't know what, like, how can you heal if you don't know what you're healing from? How can you, you know, move in a direction that works for you if you haven't realized which direction doesn't? And I think that facing ourselves holistically is the only way to do that. And in the book, I identify three areas of like connection with self. There's the body, there's the mind, and there's the emotions. And people have their favorite, and then they have their least favorite.
Right.
But I've never met an authentic person that hated their body. I've also never met an authentic person who didn't have access to their emotions. Like, all of these are equally relevant. And this is so, so important to understand. And we're going to find truths we don't like about all three. Mm. But being authentic doesn't mean being perfect, right? Being authentic just means that you are aware and responsible for how you show up in the world. That's all it is.
So yeah, it's like Katie said, being whole does not mean being happy all the time. Right. I think that's one of the biggest misnomers of this type of work. It's embracing everything, right?
Yeah, I think this life goal of like we wake up in the morning and we try to make every decision aligned with this feeling of happiness. It's like one feeling in the human experience that we're all trying to have all the time. Like that doesn't even seem like... I don't even think
it's not realistic.
It's not real.
Yeah.
Mm-mm. I don't think that's humanly possible. I don't think feel an emotion on such a high sustained amount of time. That's, I think what people are misunderstanding is that our goal should be fulfillment.
Mm-hmm. Fulfillment, not happiness.
Happiness or joy. And fulfillment comes with doing hard things.
Yeah.
Meaning comes with doing hard things. That's a part of it. If you're striving for joy, you're never going to accept yourself fully. You're never going to see the reality of your life fully. And I think it's such a shame that that's become our priority. And there's so many harmful consequences.
A nuance here I want to ask you about. So fulfillment, doing hard things, right? That's what really brings us that deep sense of, I guess you could say, joy in your life, right? And
yeah.
I think that there's also this societal conditioning, and I'm somebody who's tried to fill that hole inside with pretty much everything and failed every time. And how do you discern the nuance between I'm doing something that's genuinely fulfilling or I'm achieving because I'm addicted to external validation?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, who are you doing it for is a really great question when we move through life. Like, you're doing this, you're succeeding at this, and that can be an internal satisfaction or an external satisfaction. So sometimes it's as simple as going, what for, who for? But fulfillment is always connected to genuine value. Okay. That's where the meaning comes from. Just external accolades and accomplishments are connected to appreciation, they're connected to reward, they're connected to validation. None of those are bad. Those are also values. But I think what you need to realize is what value are you chasing? Mm-hmm. And I think the value, I'll get clients to write their values and make a hierarchy of values so that they're aware of which one they should follow. Because sometimes you have competing values. So what do you do then? Yeah. That's when you need a hierarchy. And a lot of us are not trying to self-sabotage because we're mean. A lot of us actually do these external behaviors or are addicted to these things, if that's how we want to talk about it, because it still gives us something. So when I look at a destructive behavior, I'll always go, what need is being fulfilled with this behavior? Because it might be destructive in the long run, but it is giving you something. Humans are incredibly intelligent. We don't do things if they give us nothing. Ever. We always get something. So what something are you getting? And then what is the value of that something? And is that value greater than the value of fulfillment?
Mm, that's big.
Yeah.
How do we tackle the reality that we lie to ourselves?
Oh my gosh. Stop. No.
don't do that.
Like, I just think back on
anymore.
I think back on my own awareness of self at many stages in my journey and just the conviction I had about being right. And then a year goes by and I'm like, I do nothing.
I'm going to keep my mouth shut on this one.
She's now she has it on recording. This is, now I'm just preserved for infinity.
I'm going to not say
anything. Yeah, she's just going to play this back to you.
But I think that generally speaking, we lie to ourselves and we use that to hold our place in where we think we are.
We'll be back in just a moment.
As a reminder, the Feeling Lighter podcast is a part of WeShape, a fitness app that is taking a very different approach. And I wanted to let everyone know about our upcoming Best Moves for You masterclass that WeShape is hosting that you can sign up for free. Take a look at weshape.com/class or click the link in the show notes.
And now back to the Feeling Lighter podcast.
For sure. Such a great question. Such an important and relevant question. We lie usually for two reasons. One, to preserve ourselves, because the truth is too threatening. And the other is to not have to change.
Okay.
Right. So that's the hold the reality as is. So it's not asking me to do anything else. And the other one is self-preservation. I would argue that a lot of it, if not all of it, is self-preservation. That is the main reason why I see people lie to themselves. They cannot handle the truth. They cannot handle the consequence of the truth. They cannot handle what the truth is asking of them. So the one way to deal with lying to yourself is to create something I call inner safety. If it's unsafe to handle the truth, how do you create enough safety and grounding within yourself that you can face any truth without it feeling like a threat? And that is a whole entire talk for another time. It's so much, you know, okay, little thing. It's like you keep a promise to you, like you set a promise. Did you keep it? That's a huge one. Okay, I will not keep scrolling for 2 hours, like such a silly example. I will not scroll for an hour today. I will go to bed and then you don't do it. Seems like an inconsequential thing, but it's not, because what you did is you didn't honor yourself. You didn't do what you said you would. So how can you trust yourself with bigger things when the day comes or a truth comes? You're like, I can barely trust myself to like go to bed on time. I can't face the fact that my marriage is ending or that my kid is sick or that, you know, I'm showing up in a super destructive way. That's way too much for me to handle.
And like, also, I think our generation is really stuck on, we talk a lot about this in WeShape, on the external validation. And so then I think we'll add a layer of complexity to this question and say, what if other people reflecting something to you that is not your truth inside? And how do you know? So like, let's say he's reflecting something to me. Not that this has ever happened.
This is getting personal.
And I'm like, that doesn't resonate. Like maybe an observation about a behavior or a character defect of myself. And I'm like, oh, that doesn't resonate with who I think I am. And I am willing to face, quote, I think I'm willing to face the truth. It's like, how do I know that I'm not just like lying to myself? How do I know that he's right? It's like, it's complicated, right? Because when people reflect things back to you, then... is that an opportunity to see if you're in self-denial or lying to yourself? And then what if your conclusion is different than their observation? So it's like, how do you even really, what is the truth?
I love it. And obviously this was hypothetical because Katie's perfect. And that would never happen.
This has never happened.
I'm keeping my mouth shut on this one.
We're actually navigating this very well, by the way.
Yeah, you guys, this is great. So I wrote a whole chapter in this, which is the fact that we cannot create our sense of self in isolation. What that means is we actually need mirrors, because we have blind spots. If you don't have someone reflecting your existence, how do you know that you exist? It's almost like with if you never had a physical mirror, I'm sure you would have a different relationship to your body in terms of never have seen your body be reflected at all. And that's what other people do for us. I do not think we can go into a cave, find our authenticity, and come out. Right. The question who we are is not answered cognitively. It's answered by how we live our life. Who you are is how you show up. And what others do is reflect that back to you. Now, the danger of it is when people reflect inaccurately. You're right. That is one of the hardest things. It can make you feel crazy. it can undermine all the effort that you're doing. And that's something that happened to me during my journey. Is like, I was a year or two in of like really trying to change. And I would have people bring shit up from like 5 years ago, from grade seven. And from the way they described me, I could tell that they were not seeing me at all. What they were doing is they were describing a previous version of myself. And then it made me go, well, am I still that version? Mm-hmm. Am I just lying to myself that I've somehow evolved? But maybe I'm still that girl that does X, Y, and Z. Because that's what they're reflecting back to me. And that's the danger of it. So we cannot change the fact that people will impact the way we understand ourselves. What we can control is who does it.
Uh-huh.
So does this person have your best interest at heart? What blind spots does this person have? Why are they reflecting this back? So we do need people to call us out. We do need people to reflect back things we don't want to see about ourselves. But we need to be really careful with who we allow to do that. And keep evaluating if they're still a good person for that role.
That's a good point.
So
that's a really good
there
point.
Isn't a clear answer, but hopefully that was helpful.
But we need those experiences is what, you know, I hear you saying. And we have to have those conversations. And they're difficult, but they're important.
For sure.
You talk about living in regret and it being super unproductive around, like, you know, our experiences and our history. Can you talk about, like, why it's unproductive and then what a better, like, alternative is to that?
Yeah. Regret is not productive because it's in the past. Mm-hmm. Whatever you're regretting happened in the past and your life is in the present. You're just not living your life when you live in the regret. And so for me, regret is also a very damaging emotion when we sit with it for too long, because what it's saying is, this is now shaped who I've become. This is now, it's almost like saying, because I did or did not do this thing, my life is this way, and I am a victim of my own life, and I'm going to be attached to this thing forever, and I will not look at the future. And this is like all of the, it's very complex. And I think the greatest thing we can do is acknowledge what we've done wrong, learn from it, and then forgive ourselves. Now, that's obviously a lot easier said than done, but I think it's a lot more productive. And there is nothing beneficial about allowing a mistake to define you. It does not have to. It defines you in that moment. It can inform you moving forward, but regret tells me that your mistake has now defined you and that you live within the reality of this mistake and that you are not present and conscious and responsible for your present moment.
I've never heard regret described like that before.
Yeah. It's like the antithesis to like healing and getting through the situation is like sitting with the regret and like you said, not like letting it define your day to day
and not creating the like your own next evolution.
That's
like excessive regret. That's what I mean. It's like 30 years later, you're still like, I should have taken her number. Like, you should feel regret for things you've done. Like, that is a natural, healthy human emotion. But if you're stuck in it, that's when it becomes unhealthy.
What if you're stuck in it because the person that you hurt won't let it go? And it's a constant reminder to you.
I was just going to say something really callous, but then you let them go. Right? Like, at some point, you're going to have to choose between your mental health and that relationship. You're going to have to choose between your life and them being in your life. And that sounds really horrible, and I understand. But if you went through the phases of like apologizing, changing your behavior, asking them how you can repair the relationship, whatever it is, and you've done it and you've shown up, and they are still choosing their own path, I think sometimes we do need to set those boundaries or part ways because their regret shouldn't be carried by you.
Why do people have a hard time forgiving themselves?
Because there's something I study this a lot in my graduate degree because I was studying moral injury, but we have found that betrayal is felt more intensely the closer the individual is to you, right? Mm-hmm. So when your husband betrays you, when your best friend betrays you, it hurts a lot more than when a random colleague or someone on the street betrays you. Now imagine being betrayed by yourself. Imagine being hurt by yourself. Mm-hmm. Imagine inflicting harm to yourself. You are the closest person to you. And so betrayal trauma, or however you want to identify it, is so real. And so forgiving yourself is the hardest because the hurt is the deepest.
Mm, I've never heard it. Dang, you're throwing truth bombs at us today.
Thank you.
Yeah. I know we're up on our time, but I want to just thank you so much for this really fruitful conversation and just this idea of self-loss and rediscovery and creating anew. I think it will be really valuable to our listeners, especially with the work that we're doing here at WeShape. But before we let you go, we have to ask the big question around here, which is, what is a belief that you once had that you no longer have that has shifted your life in a really meaningful way?
Great question, by the way. I love it.
Thank you.
The belief I had was that there was one right way to live your life.
Same.
And I had to let that go. And it opened up possibilities. It showed me the true freedom that I had. It allowed me to play with my existence. And it allowed me to belong to myself rather than the rules and guidelines and regulations that were imposed on me. So that was a huge one.
That's very powerful.
Excellent one.
Thank you so much for sharing.
Well, thank you again for your time. And let people know where they can find you.
Sure. So I'm most active on Instagram at millennial.therapist. You can buy my book anywhere books are sold. It's called It's On Me. And if you're interested, it's on me. And there's a little mirror there in case you didn't. You know.
And then I write
longer form essays on Substack, and it's called Notes from My Phone. And it's things that I don't think are as digestible for Instagram, but things I think about deeply. And you can find me there as well.
Wonderful. Awesome. Thank you again, and we will see everyone next week.
Thank you.